This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. The last time we saw Joe Pantoliano on TV, he lost his head. More specifically, his character of loose cannon mobster Ralph Cifaretto, one of the best things about the HBO series The Sopranos last season, had been killed by James Gandolfini's Tony Soprano. Not just killed, but decapitated, with his head stuck in a bowling bag. Now Pantoliano is about to return to TV as the star of his own CBS series, The Handler. It's the best new series of the fall season, and this time, Pantoliano plays the good guy. He plays the head of a group of FBI undercover agents, and not only dispatches them, Mission Impossible style, but trains them.
Get it. We're going somewhere where we can talk.
Talk right here.
Look, you think you could just sell on my corner my customers because you want to?
I didn't see any sign that said that you own the street.
You weren't looking close enough.
You got a map in your car?
What?
Why don't you just show me what part of the city you don't own and I'll go sell over there?
Ready yet? Get in the car. I'll give you a ride and show you myself.
Why don't you just find me some dope and I can stay where I am and we can both be happy. What?
No, you can't do that. No, that's entrapment. You gotta get him to make the suggestion. Let him come to you. But the attitude was good. I like that. You're not a pushover and you didn't get in the car. That's important. And listen, what you did, getting sexy with me?
Yeah.
Don't do it unless you plan on going all the way with it.
If The Handler catches on, it'll be a nice payoff for a reliably entertaining actor who has appeared in more than 60 films, including Risky Business, The Fugitive, The Matrix, and Memento. He's also done great work for TV, including Frank Sinatra's role in the miniseries version of From Here to Eternity, and a pre-Sopranos role as a mob boss in a brilliant but short-lived CBS series, Easy Streets. Pantoliano also has written a memoir called Who's Sorry Now? About growing up in Hoboken in the 50s and early 60s. It's now out in paperback. His parents were on the fringes of crime. His stepfather was connected. Pantoliano spoke with Terry Gross last year.
Now, your new memoir, Who's Sorry Now?, is about your coming of age. And although you're not from a mafia family and your family is nothing like The Sopranos, you weren't unfamiliar with crime when you were growing up, and neither was the rest of your family. Mm-hmm. Did they know about that? The people at The Sopranos, did they know about that when they asked you to be in the cast?
No, not at all. David Chase knew me from 1979, when I did From Here to Eternity, the remake of the novel, and I played Maggio, and he had seen me in that and was interested in putting me in a pilot that was kind of a spin-off when he was working on the Rockford Files. I didn't get the job, and I saw him infrequently over the years through a mutual friend, and then he called me, and I was available to come, and that's how it happened. But we there was never any kind of flushing out or interviews or tell me about who you, where you came from, background. He had, I don't think, to my knowledge, that he had even an idea that I was from New Jersey.
Now tell us what your mother and father did for a living.
Well, Daddy worked at Standard Brands up until 1962 when he had a heart attack.
At Standard
Mommy,
Brands?
Standard Brands in Hoboken, New Jersey, which is now called the Lipton Tea Building. It's actually a high-rise apartments. And Mom, she worked at her father's seamstress shop. She was a sewer, and she I remember we would do patches, that she would do piecework. They would cut the sergeant patches and corporal patches and into off of a whole sheet of material, and then she'd get X amount of cents for each piece that she cut. When we went down the shore, for a time, she acted as a bookie, working for a local bookie in the area, and that way she could make $4 or $5 a week and enable us to stay down the shore for the summer. I worked for her. I was a runner. She would give me the receipts and the money, and I'd go down to the bakery on the way to the swimming pool and give them their money. And one of the reasons why I wanted to tell this story is in my culture, that is the culture of a New Jersey kid growing up, and I've started to see movies like The Godfather, or I read books like The Fortunate Pilgrim. The women, for me, were always in the background of these assertive, strong men. And my feeling was that the women in my life were much more assertive than the men. And the idea that, you know, Who's Sorry Now is taken from the song that my mother would sing, the Connie Francis song that my mother would sing when she would get the men in her life to blow their stack. She would needle them to the point where they would blow their stack. And I wrote a screenplay first based on my life called Just Like Mona. And the point that I was making in that, and I think I hope that it's the point, that it took me 45 years to realize that I am just like my mother, that the strengths that I have and the tenacity that I was born with or inherited was from her, not from the men in my life.
Now, when she recruited you when you were a kid to run numbers for her, did you ever think to yourself, how could she do this to me? This is illegal. It's the kind of thing we could get busted for.
No, I mean, it was so simple. Take this down to the store. It was done ever so lightly. You know, with Cousin Flory, before he died, several years, he was older now, 75, 76, and starting to become frail from emphysema. You know, tobacco killed my entire family. My father from lung cancer, my mother from several strokes and a heart attack, and Flory from emphysema. But Flory one time was telling me that when he was a kid, at like 11 years old, he was delivering heroin, that his grandmother and father and uncle would cut heroin on their dining room table, and they would stiff cotton swabs in their nose as to not get the fumes from the heroin. And then little Flory, they put it in little brown vials, glass vials with a cork, and he would go down Mott Street and Hester Street and deliver it. And at that point, that wasn't illegal. In 1922, heroin and cocaine was still legal sale.
Well, you mentioned your cousin Flory. He was your mother's third cousin. And then later in life became your mother's lover and your mm-hmm. stepfather, or perhaps father. When you were, I don't know, about 12 maybe, your mother said to you, your yeah. father, he's not really your father. Cousin Flory is your father.
Yeah.
Was Cousin Flory really your father? Did you ever?
I don't think so. I think, although he was a father figure to me, somebody asked me this question recently and said, why haven't you ever done DNA to find out for sure? And the truth is that I was blessed with two fathers, and that this man, Florio, came into my life just at the right time when I was just about to fall off the edge of the table. And he was there to catch me, and he saw in me innocence and a future that was robbed from him. He was born into a lifestyle that he never had a chance.
He did a lot of time in a federal penitentiary.
He spent combined time, over 21 years of his life, he spent inside federal penitentiary. So he got out of the life at 51 years old, and so he spent the last 27 years of his life outside of prison working as a working stiff, driving a truck, whatever it took to provide for the family that he chose.
What did he do to land him in the pen?
Well, the last one was heroin trafficking, but he did a variety of things, counterfeiting, hijacking. You know, in doing the research for doing the book, I tried to find his papers. I called the FBI and tried to get his rap sheet, but it's gotten too far back. It's too old.
So here's this guy who was, you know, selling heroin and hijacking trucks, et cetera, and he's the guy who prevented you from falling off the edge. What did he do for you? What was going wrong in your life, and how did he help you?
Well, you know, when mommy said that Flory, Cousin Flory, was my real dad, I think she did that to protect herself, because she was riddled with guilt about taking Flory over daddy, and she was afraid. Looking back now, that she was afraid that I was going to take daddy's side. And it was really important for her to be the victim of this. When I talked to my cousin Antoinette, and I reflect on that in the end of the book, when Antoinette said several days before mommy died, or weeks, she said that she was wrong for doing what she did to Monk.
And Monk's the name of your father.
Yeah, my father was Monk, Dominic Monk Pantoliano. But Flory really loved me. And he really wanted the best for me, to the point where he threatened me if I did something wrong, that there would be serious repercussions. And I believed him.
And you hadn't had that before. You hadn't anybody who cared enough.
I never had. By that point, teachers had written me off. My parents were afraid. You see, my mommy and daddy were afraid to go out and reach out and grab at the gold coin. They wanted the best for me, but they didn't want me to be so ambitious because they felt that I'd be hurt. Who was I to think that I was entitled to be an actor? You know, that wasn't there for us or our kind. And I think a lot of my family members felt that way and frightened. Mommy didn't want me, you know, what were people going to say, that I was going to move to New York as a single male at 19 years old? I mean, and they were also really superstitious about all of that stuff. So Flory kept saying, don't worry about it. Do this. You got to do this. Go. He found an actor and he introduced me to him, and they took me down to HB Studios and I met Herbert Berghoff. And I was still in high school when I started studying acting.
Let's get back to our interview with Joe Pantoliano. His memoir, Who's Sorry Now, is out in paperback. And this fall, he stars as an undercover agent in the new CBS series, The Handler.
How connected was your cousin Flory, or your stepfather Flory?
Well, Flory was never made. He was never indoctrinated into the organization known as Cosa Nostra. But he was Billadina Murano, who I talk about in the book, was my great uncle. He was a descendant of the Genovese family. Mommy and Uncle Pete used to run the Italian lottery. That's what Grandpa Gus, Dopey Gus, my grandfather, he organized that, and that was Vito-sanctioned. So Uncle Pete and Mommy would have to take the money from the Italian lottery to Vito when Vito was a young man. So they all loved Vito, and Vito was a part of their lives. He would go down the shore with them. And Flory was being groomed to be in that. Joe King was a mentor of Florio's. And I remember meeting Joe King when Flory came home from prison. And Flory loved him like a father. Flory also had a father that, Joseph Isabella, who had become a user of the same poison that he was selling on the street, heroin, and he died a junkie. So Flory had really strong issues about the use of it. And he, you know, I didn't. As a young adult, I was totally conflicted by what he had done, mm-hmm. but I would never have the courage to confront him on it.
Because your stepfather, Flory, was pretty connected, although he wasn't a made man, and you knew that he'd spend time in the pen, you knew he did a lot of crimes, were you in awe of his status in the crime world, or was that an embarrassment for you? I mean, how did you feel about that?
It had serious cachet in the neighborhood to have a guy who was a known wise guy from New York. I mean, the New York City, it was a big deal. People would whisper, and the kids in the neighborhood treated you with respect. It was like having an athlete or a movie star staying over your house.
How much did you want to know about what he'd really done?
Nothing. He'd never brought it home. We didn't know. He was in it very shortly. You know, in the book I describe when they got arrested, Mommy, my sister Marianne, and Flory, that Sunday afternoon. And it was at that point where we had moved out of the projects, we had moved off of welfare, we were living in Fort Lee. He had spent $10,000 in cash on furnishing this new apartment, and he was waiting to work a deal with his cousins who were in the gas station business, that he wanted to get that money. He had $40,000 in cash in 64 or 65. That was a lot of money. And while he was waiting to start a life with that money, he lost it all at the track. You'd go to the Big A every day, and within 4 or 5 months, we were broke again. We were back in the same situation, this time with a lot of fancy furniture.
Well, you know, you say in your book that because you were a fat kid and on the short side, you were a real target for abuse from the other kids. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you would, like, entertain them, and that would prevent them from beating you up. But sometimes when you got beaten up, your mother would insist on you telling her who was responsible for it, and she'd go after them, which was really embarrassing for you.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't insist. She just took over. You know, it's kind of hard to come home when your shirt's all torn up and your nose is bleeding and you got a big black eye, and she's going, what happened? Nothing. Don't tell me you don't have nothing. You're summoning a bitch. Get over here. And she'd grab one of my friends and put him up against the wall, like, you know, James Cagney. Tell me who did this, right? And then she'd go down and with a stick, you know, with the broomstick, and just whack the hell out of the kid.
Was it embarrassing or what?
It was horrifying. It was humiliating. And, you know, she was like a battle axe. I mean, she was this big steam engine. She wasn't afraid of anybody.
Now, in your memoir, you describe how your mother fought with your father all the time. Lots of four-letter words when they were fighting. No one was going to think about protecting you from from that language. And then when your mother lived with your stepfather, again, lots of big fights. Did you have any sense that two people could live together and actually get along without fighting all the time?
No, in fact, I mean, after 15 years of therapy, I didn't want to be attached to a girl. I mean, during high school, I never had a girlfriend. And I didn't go to the prom when I graduated. And the only reason why I graduated high school was as I thought that I'd be around my mother less that way. At least I'd have to deal with her until 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon. And that's, in fact, by then I started working when I was 12 years old. I worked at my uncle's station. Gas station, and I worked at the AMP, and then when I moved to New York, I was a waiter, and I always had a job. But I thought that all women were like my mother, and that they would expect them to turn into that. I'm still waiting for my wife to turn into my mother. I got one of the sweetest, kindest wives, my wife Nancy. We've been together 13 years. When I married her, I thought, well, now that we're married, she's going to turn into my mother. I'm waiting, you know, I'm still waiting for the other shoe to fall.
This is
and she hasn't yet.
Uh-huh.
And I'm surrounded by women, Terry. Everyone. I have three daughters, a nanny. I have my wife, Nancy. The cats are female. And the only male is Abbott, my dog, and me. And we've both been neutered. My wife had me fixed 2 years ago, and Abbott was fixed 8 years ago.
Now, when you were growing up, school was really hard. You didn't do very well in school. And you had an undiagnosed case of dyslexia, which was diagnosed later. So that explains why reading was so difficult. When did you end up getting it diagnosed?
Well, I never got it diagnosed. It was just assumed that it was dyslexia because of the way I was spelling things and the fact that I presently, when I was 18 years old, see, I'd been left back three times. When I was a kid in the Hoboken school system, there were 6 months graduating terms, like 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B. When I was in the third grade, I was in 3A, and then they said, well, we're going to just combine it to yearly graduations going on to the next class. So then I got skipped 6 months. So by then, I was really screwed up. I was already behind in the 3A part, right? I should have been in 2B, but it got to be such. I was so riddled with anxiety. I started getting boils, and then by the time I reached high school, I was almost 19 because I'm born in September. So when I graduated my senior year, it was in June. I was going to be 19 in September, and it was in the middle of the year, in February, I think it was, when I did the high school play, and never had a need for reading. You know, I watched television all the time, so I didn't really have a need for reading. I watched the nightly news, and I got my information from that, and it got to a point where I realized that this reading thing was something my teacher, Miss Damiano, Mr. Fredericks, they said, look, you have an aptitude for this acting thing. This is something that you could work at and maybe be successful at, but if that's the case, you're going to need how to learn how to read. So I read my first book my senior year in high school, and he gave me, I was at gym class, and Mr. Fredericks came and gave me Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver.
That was your first book?
Yeah, he thought it took me 3 weeks, 4 weeks to read it.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I mean, after that, the next book I read was the Valachi Papers, then was The Godfather. You know, things that I could relate to, relatable things.
Uh-huh. So was reading a problem for you when you started acting seriously, or were you good enough by then that you could...
No, it was I mean, it took 7 years. It took a long time to. I had to. I would have to prepare for an audition. I'd have to put 2 or 3 hours into each audition, and then I would go in. It was like double acting. I would go in and pretend that I was reading off the page, when in fact I had memorized it.
No, I think your real breakthrough film part was in Risky Business, which was also the movie that launched Tom Cruise's career. And in this movie, Tom Cruise plays a high school kid whose parents are leaving him alone in their big suburban home for a few days while they're out of town. And then he befriends a woman who he doesn't realize is a prostitute, who's had a fight with her pimp. She and her girlfriend, who's also a prostitute, are staying at Tom Cruise's house when you, Guido the pimp, shows up to take these two girls home. Let me play a clip from that scene.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave. No, the door's locked. He's starting to give me a stomachache.
Good. I hope it hurts.
So open the door or what?
We don't go home. We don't need you anymore.
Look, shut your mouth.
No. Listen, well, maybe we don't work for you anymore.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Right.
Then who you work for, huh? Who? You don't work for me.
Who? You don't work for me.
Maybe we work for Joel now.
She's only kidding. I hope so. Look, Joel, you look like a smart kid. So I'm going to tell you something which I'm sure you'll understand. Now, you're having fun now, right? Right, Joel? Time of your life? As sluggish as you can, and never, ever f*** with another man's livelihood. Now, if you're smart, like I hope you are, you're not going to make me come back here.
Joe Pantoliano and Tom Cruise in a scene from Risky Business. What's the biggest leap that you took in changing your look for a film, your look or your manner?
Oh, gosh. I did a Western called El Diablo, and I played a Truman Capote-type writer of Western novelas. And that was really fun. I mean, I was imitating Katharine Hepburn, and I talked like this, and I was with Anthony Edwards and Lou Gossett Jr., and I had a really, really wonderful time working on it.
That's great. So what's it like now when you're given a new script? Can you read it pretty well?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that I'm probably... it takes me a couple hours. I would say it takes me a minute... No, it takes me about a half a minute a page, depending on how much dialogue. But I read a lot now. I enjoy reading, and that was the greatest thing, is the world of books. I collect first editions now. I have a modest
really?
Collection.
Uh-huh.
But
of what?
Modern day 20th century authors.
Huh. Interesting. So how has being a movie star changed your standing in the old neighborhood? Do you know anybody else there? Have they all been driven out by gentrification?
See, I don't look at myself as a movie star. I always thought that a movie star is somebody that makes, you know, $5 million, $2 million, $1 million a movie. People see me, and because I'm a personality and that I'm someone that's recognized, they think that I've lived this gorgeous life, and I'm driving Maseratis and living in a palace. And I'm here to tell you, Joey Pants doesn't own a palace. I'm just a working actor, and my friends and my family are proud of me. One of the nicest things that was said to me yesterday is my friend Joey Fiano, who I talk about in the book, who's lost his father, and a week later he lost his mother, and at 18 years old raised his siblings. And he called me up yesterday. I hadn't talked to him in 10 years. And he said to me, I'm going to go get the book. And he says, Joey, you got to live all of your dreams. All of your dreams came true. And they have, you know? And now I get to tell this story. So whether nobody reads the book, this is something my kids could read someday, and it's a document of where they came from. I think that's great.
It sounds like your book really was like therapy for you. Have you actually been in therapy?
Yeah, I was in therapy for 15 years. Oh, God.
did that, I mean, did you understand the role that, for instance, your mother had played in your life and how overbearing she was in your life and what impact
that
had on
you? Well, I'll
tell
you how I got into therapy.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
We were working at O'Neill's Balloon. I was a waiter, and Flory was the manager.
That's a restaurant right near Lincoln Center in Manhattan.
That's right. It's not there anymore, but it's owned by Patrick O'Neill, an actor. And here I am now, an actor who owns a restaurant. I have a restaurant in South Norwalk called Bamboo, Connecticut. My sister Marianne quit school at 15, and she was beside herself, my mother. And I was going to acting school with John Lennon, and one of the kids was taking this group therapy thing. So I said, Ma, there's this guy, he's the group therapy thing. Maybe you should take Marianne and talk to him. Maybe he can help her out. So she did. And they were going to come and meet us at O'Neill's Balloon. Well, my mother was fit to be tied. And I said, what's the matter? She goes, this no good SOB says that your sister's problems are my fault. And I just went like, somebody said this to her? And the next day I called the guy up. And I got to meet you because if you're telling my mother that it's her, that she's the reason we're so screwed up, I have to meet you. And that's how I started the group therapy.
One last thing. When did you first start being called Joey Pants?
The kids called me Joey Pants, and it was always because people couldn't say the name.
Even in an Italian neighborhood?
They call you Pantliana, Pantleone, Pumpliana. I mean, they murdered the English language in that town. And so they would call me Pants. They'd say Pants because, you know, Pantalone means pants in Italian.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
I had a ball.
Actor Joe Pantoliano. His memoir about growing up in Hoboken is now out in paperback, and his new TV series, The Handler, premieres on CBS later this month.